This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
I'm interviewing Professor Ian Shipsey of Oxford University, who's involved with a project called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. So, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So you've given a colloquium at the Physics Department of the University of Manchester today, and it covered really a very large project. So could you give us an overview of what that project is all about?
Yeah, so the project, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, synoptic means big picture, is to take a big picture of the universe and to take that picture over and over again. Over the course of three nights, we'll see the whole sky from a mountaintop in Chile, and we'll see more of the sky in the first month of operation, more of the universe than any previous telescope. And that's possible because of modern technology, very fast and very sensitive CCDs, a panoramic telescope that sees a great deal of sky in just one glimpse, one view, and great software and powerful computers to analyze that software. So that's basically the project, make a movie of the universe.
So the LSST, as you were saying, will have a mirror 8 meters across, which is very large. It's comparable to the largest optical telescopes in the world. So what will be the difference between this and any other very large optical telescope?
Oh, yeah. So the difference is in the design. It's called a Paul Baker design. And so the idea is to have a very, very short focal length so that you see a very large amount of sky at any given time. So the full moon is half a degree across, for example. And a typical telescope, for example, the Keck 10 meter, would look at a piece of sky about 0.2 degrees across. So that's smaller than the full moon. We can see a piece of sky 3.5 degrees across, so that's 10 square degrees, all at once. And so that's because of the optical design that we can do that. And so if you now have a telescope that can see a lot of sky, and you put that with a really, really big CCD, 64 centimeters across, made up of a lot of smaller CCDs, but a total of 3.2 gigapixels of CCD, you can capture that big piece of sky, and you can do it quickly. And so every 15 seconds, we'll record the photons. We'll then read out the CCD, take another image for another 15 seconds, and then move this 350-ton telescope to a new patch of sky, a little bit away from the last one, let it stop trembling, and then take another couple of pictures, and then keep doing that. And the fact that we're seeing so much sky, and the fact that we can record that image so quickly, means that in just three nights you can see the whole sky. So that's not been done before. And that enables you to take a snapshot of the universe. And then, having done that in three nights, you start all over again and repeat the process. And in this way, you build up the movie every 3 days. From that movie, you can see, for example, things that change. Some things that change may be near-Earth objects, that asteroids, for example, that could be on a collision course to Earth. Other things could be new types of variable star, or mergers of different objects, like a black hole with a black hole that could lead to, we've never seen that before, but it could lead to a huge flash of light that we could record. And the ability to do that kind of thing is greatly increased when you can see so much of the universe at once. And so you open up essentially the time domain in astronomy. In other words, instead of a static image, you have a moving image, and there's a big difference in information content. To give you an idea of that, if you look at a picture from the Hubble Space Telescope, incredibly beautiful, and then you say, that tells us a lot, but we don't know much about what happened just before that image was taken or just after that image was taken. And if we did, maybe we'd know more about how something evolves or changes. And the equivalent to that on Earth would be if you walked into a room and you found a wedding cake, and the wedding cake is on the floor, and it's all broken up, and there's a bride and groom figure, and they're smashed up, all on the floor. So that tells you something bad has happened, right? But you actually don't know what. You don't know whether it was a row between the bride and groom, or whether it was an earthquake. But if you had a movie of that, you'd see what happened. And so what we're trying to do on a cosmic scale is the same thing. Take the movie of the universe unfolding. And this is a very historic time in astrophysics and particle physics, because we didn't have the technology before to do that. So now we can build the telescope, we can instrument it with a CCD, we can put all that information in a database, and we can analyze it. And so this is a special moment in time, and we can do that for the first time, and we're fortunate to have the support of many scientists around the world to do it.
It does almost sound like fantasy physics, because I think sometimes people imagine that in astronomy, somebody is looking at the whole sky all the time, but really that's not currently happening.
So it's game-changing.
And I suppose you should ask, when is it going to all come online?
That's a good question. So we believe that we'll get the final green light from the National Science Foundation, one of the US funding agencies, in May. And that would allow us to begin the construction of the project in July. And then 8 years and 3 months later, we'll be doing science. So it's October 2022 that we'll be ready. It takes a long while to build that telescope, build that camera, build all of the data management system, all the software and infrastructure.
But you explained that the project's been in the pipeline for quite a
long
number
time,
of years.
That's correct. The original ideas go back to the 1990s. And in those days, it was called the Dark Matter Telescope, because dark matter was cool. We didn't know what it was. We still don't know what it is. It's still cool. But in the interim, people realize that there's a lot more you can do with a telescope than that type of telescope, than image dark matter through its effect on visible matter. You can actually, for example, learn about dark energy, a quixotic substance that we don't understand. If we understand it, data from this telescope and other sources, other experiments will help us understand it, we hope, could pinpoint why it is that quantum mechanics and general relativity, the two great worldviews of physics, can be unified in some way. At the moment, they're inconsistent with each other. And so trying to reconcile them would be a great piece of progress in fundamental physics. And so that's one of the reasons why people like particle physicists are on the experiment, as well as astronomers on what they would call the telescope. And computer scientists join us because they get very excited by a database that will have 37 billion objects in it, something close to 30 trillion measurements. And these measurements should wish to correlate with other measurements in the same database. It provides a data mining challenge. That's a grand challenge in big data. And so that brings together three types of people all working together on this project. And so that's another way in which it's a little bit different to a traditional astronomy project.
That's interesting. It brings me on to the next question, because you were mentioned there the 37 billion objects.
Yeah.
So when you talked about the different science goals and the different sorts of objects you could find, there was a very wide range. Could you just give us an overview of all the different things, and maybe we'll go into detail on those different parts?
Right. So, I mean, one of the first things we'll do by imaging the universe night after night and then co-adding those images is we'll see further and further into the universe. And based on how many galaxies we can see today, we can predict roughly how many galaxies we might expect to find. And the answer is around at least 10 billion new ones, and quite possibly many more. So there's some uncertainty in the estimates, but high-quality measurements, very bright galaxies, will probably get 5 billion. But when you add all of them, it could be as many as 20 billion galaxies, which in itself is a huge number. But it also is an interesting number, because if you wish to enable the public to participate in this science, and one way that you could do so is to hook up every school in the world to the telescope, essentially, download to that school every three nights an image of a tiny patch of sky which belongs to that school. Sky's a big place, so you can divide up the sky, one school, one tiny piece of sky, and then people at the school would analyze those images, and every three nights a new image would be added. And in time, galaxies would come into view that no one had seen before, and young children in Manchester, or let's say in Chile where the telescope is, or elsewhere, can discover island universes for themselves. So galaxies are the basic thing we're going to be finding lots and lots of. The biggest single type of object that we'll find are galaxies in large numbers. And those galaxies we'll use to measure, for example, dark energy. So would you like me to tell you how we might do that?
Yes, certainly.
So there's a number of ways that you can go about that. And one of them is that galaxies are large enough objects that, as seen from Earth, they're clearly not stars, they're extended objects. So we know that we can tell this is a galaxy that's not a star. Now, the galaxy itself and its physical size, as seen from Earth, will depend, of course, on how far away it is. But it will also, the shape of what we see will depend on how the light has traveled from that galaxy to us. And as it travels through eons of time and through billions of light years distance, that light courses through dark matter structures and is bent by the gravity of the dark matter. And so the image that we see is a bit like if I was looking at you through frosted glass. The frosted glass represents the dark matter that's causing the image of you, your face, to change. And by looking, having an idea of what a human being looks like, and then seeing what I would see through the frosted glass, I can figure out how much frosted glass there is, what it's like, what shape it has, and so on. And we can do the same thing with these galaxy images, we can reconstruct what the dark matter was intervening between those galaxies and us. Now, it turns out the amount of dark matter that's there as a function of distance, as a function of redshift, as a function of time, tells us about dark energy, because dark energy is like anti-gravity, stopping dark matter forming clumps. The dark matter, because of its gravity, wants to form clumps. So if we compare how much clumping there is of dark matter as a function of time, we're actually measuring the influence of dark energy as a function of time, and that will help us understand how much dark energy there is at different epochs in the universe. And that would then get to the heart of what dark energy is, because whether it changes with time is a fundamental question about it. So that's one aspect of what you do with galaxies. There's another thing you can do with galaxies. Look at your own one. Our home galaxy is a wonderful place, but also a place we don't fully understand how it was put together. And we're able with LSST, because of its exquisite imaging, to see an incredible number of stars. Most of them will be in our galaxy, something like 17 billion or so stars. And many of those we can, if they're close enough, we can understand their proper motions. We can make precise trigonometric measurements of them, figure out their distances and so on. And for more distant ones in the galaxy, we rely on signatures like the fact that certain types of star vary in time in a specific way. And we know how bright those stars are. And so we can work out their distance simply by how many photons we see for that star. And through these different techniques, we can build up three-dimensional images of our galaxy that have much more sensitivity than any previous images, for example, those made by Sloan, which are path-breaking images of tidal streams that are the remnants of dwarf galaxies that were helped to build up and aggregate to make our own galaxy. But the images that Sloan has taken are of a piece of sky that goes out to maybe 50 or 100 kiloparsecs, and only part of that volume. We can go out to a few hundred kiloparsecs because we have a bigger telescope. They can see fainter objects. So we can see, for example, Lyra variable stars across the galaxy and even out beyond it. So we'll image 50 times more volume of the galaxy, and we'll be able to see subtle structures in the galaxy. It will help us understand how the galaxy was put together. And that also helps us understand dark matter and its role in that, because dark matter is, of course, most of what the galaxy is made of.
Of our own galaxy as
well. So, yeah, so that's, yeah, so our own galaxy and all the other galaxies are used in different ways to understand how the universe was built. But then we have another aspect to LSST, which is completely different. And that is to look at tiny objects, tiny, maybe 100 meters across, in our own solar system. As you know, the solar system is full of stuff that we haven't yet invented. What, by inventing all of the stuff in the solar system, we'll be in a better position to understand how the solar system evolved and why it is the way it is today. Everything from the migration and the orbits of planets to all of the families, different types of asteroids, the comets and so on. And because we'll be able to find many of these things simply because we're making a movie. And the movie is very sensitive to what has moved. Things in the solar system will move because they're close to us. So their angles will change with respect to our telescope and the objects that we're seeing in the distance beyond them, the fixed stars. And so from that, we'll be able to detect, for example, we hope, 90% of all of the near-Earth asteroids, including those that are potentially hazardous. So 90% of them. At the moment, only a few percent have been seen. These are important things to find, partly because they help us understand the dynamics and development of the solar system, but also partly because some of them may actually hit us one day, and it would be nice to know before that happens so that we can do something about it. In fact, in the US, Congressman Brown, some years ago, was so concerned that they directed NASA to find 90% of all potentially hazardous asteroids larger than 140 meters across by 2020. NASA doesn't know how to do that, so back in those days, we said, hey, we'll help with that. And indeed we will, except that by the time we turn onto the sky, it will be past 2020. But nevertheless, without LSST, there's no obvious way that we'll find most of them in any reasonable time. And finding them will be important. So that's one of the smallest objects in the solar system. The asteroid is another key part of the scientific program of LSST. And then the fourth part is simply things that change on grand scales, whether they are supernova suddenly exploding, new types of supernovae we didn't know exist, flaring stars, mergers of black holes with other objects, things that we haven't had much chance to see in the universe yet. We know they probably exist at some level, but we haven't been looking at enough of the sky for long enough to see these things. And so we're simply looking at more sky more often would lead to many discoveries in fundamental physics, in solar system physics, in galactic physics, and in transient objects and their physics.
Wow. That's an incredible range of things that will be done. You mentioned that this couldn't easily be done before. So how will we now be able to go about dealing with the enormous quantity of data that's going to be generated? I mean, first of all, you mentioned the CCD, so all those little camera chips to capture it. Then you've got to transmit it, store it, and then people have to look at it. So how will that whole pipeline work?
Well, that's a big challenging part of the project. As challenging as building the camera and building the telescope. It's one of the three pillars of LSST. So the basic idea is that the camera records information, and then after 15 seconds, we'll put a shutter across and we'll read out that CCD. Now, there's 3 gigapixels of CCDs, and so 2 bytes of information will come out from each pixel of the CCD. So we're already at 6 gigabytes of information. And that will pass on a fiber optic network to the nearest town in Chile, and from there up fiber optic cables to the United States, to the National Supercomputing Center. And at that point, they will look at the image data, raw image data. They'll make corrections for it, and they'll compare it to other images of the same patch of sky that we've taken before and make a difference image. That difference image will tell us what's new. And then we'll compare that to what we expect to be there at that time that we know should be moving. For example, there's an asteroid passing through the field of view and so on. And we'll remove all of those things, and then we'll be left with alerts that are interesting things, and we'll send them out to the world every 60 seconds. And we estimate that there'll be several million new things, not new things in the sense that they're fundamental discoveries, but things that could be followed up and would be interesting for people to follow up.
So you might have to try and filter who wants to know about which particular thing.
That's right. I mean, so we'll provide information about many things of this object. Maybe we know something about the object, for example, its orbital elements, because it was something that we were expecting, like an asteroid. And we'll simply say, well, that's an asteroid. We see it there. But there's other things that we don't know what they are. But we'll give you how bright it is, for example. What was the filter? What were the other relevant observing conditions? And then we will come back. You see, 1 hour later, we come back to the same patch of sky and we image it again. And so we'd already be able to gain more information about the object at that point and release that information coordinated with 1 hour ago. And that can help to understand such things as orbital motion in things like the solar system, for example, or immediate variability in the object. So we'll pass all of that information out to the world. And it will be a challenge for our astronomy community to then follow up.
That's wonderful. You've told us about a huge number of things that the telescope would do. Maybe just the last thing. I was particularly interested in actually how it would involve people sort of processing the data, because even now you have things like what they call the Zooniverse and Galaxy Zoo websites where people go and classify galaxies, and there are millions of them. And you're talking about having billions of them. It just occurred to me that you're talking about more than one galaxy for each person
on the Earth. Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, that's where the idea of involving more of the public in science becomes not just something that's a nice idea to do. It actually becomes essential, I think. We'll have a catalogue of objects that far exceeds the number of people on the planet. And so there's no limit to the amount of opportunities for people to get involved in the science. And the classification of objects, the public are quite good at doing that kind of thing, actually, as has been shown with Zoo Universe and other things, Galaxy Zoo. So I think we're going to see a lot of developments in those areas. A lot of the people currently on the project are very excited by the outreach opportunities that it presents. I mentioned one earlier, you know, putting the computers in the schools. But there's so much more that we hope to do. And we hope to do that in a private-public partnership with philanthropists around the world, as well as governments. And the idea that the public should participate in the science is important, first because they enable it to happen through the taxpayer dollar or pound, but also because we don't look at the universe for the first time in a new way as ourselves in some selfish fashion. We do it on behalf of humanity. That was true when we found the Higgs particle at CERN. We did that on behalf of humanity. And it's true now when we make a movie of the universe for the first time. No one of us has the right to make that movie and keep it to ourselves. It belongs to the world. And so this is a medium for bringing the world together for science, which is a wonderful medium and one that inspires young people. When I talk about this project and other projects I've had the privilege to be on around the world, one of the things that young people respond to most is the grand scale of these things, and it brings people together from around the world on a journey of discovery. And this is the power of science to raise people's spirits. It talks about the human condition in the most positive light of all. Humans are never better than when they're just trying to explore this wonderful cosmos that we're in. And so it elevates us in some way. And by elevating everybody, you can still connect to this telescope. That's what we want to make happen. It shouldn't be that if you're from a lower socioeconomic class, you have less access to the excitement of science. And maybe we'll inspire some people to pursue careers in science more than ever before. So that there are many goals like that. They're quite ambitious goals. But I think this project offers so much in terms of possibility that it would be a failure of our imagination not to aim high. As Michelangelo said, right, the biggest mistake you make is having goals that you can actually reach. You should have goals that are a bit harder than you can actually reach. Aim high, dream big, and this project's one of the things that have come out of that approach.
Great. Well, it's an extraordinary project, and hopefully once it's there, it will go on for a long time and also inspire the next generation of projects and with the next generation of researchers, whatever that might be.
That's right, that's right. What we're hoping is that, for example, the CCDs that we use are some of the best CCDs you could ever make, but we have many ideas for improving the way that we would go about doing this if we started from scratch today rather than design things 8 years ago. For example, at the moment, to know the wavelength of the photons, we put a filter in front of the camera. Now, that's a great way to know that you have, this is what this galaxy looks like in red light, or this is what this galaxy looks like in a blue filter. And we can use that information to get information about the red shift of the galaxy, because the galaxy has a distribution of light as a function of wavelength in the rest frame. And as it moves, so all of its features are red shifted. And so gradually galaxies put more light into the red filter and less light into the blue filter. And that's how you know they're red shift. However, wouldn't it be wonderful if the camera itself told you that's a blue photon, that's a red photon, no more filters? So that's the kind of idea we're working on at the moment for the next generation, so that we will be able to, in 1/6 the time, because we have 6 filters, get the same amount of information we're getting today in 6 years in 1 year. And that will open up all kinds of new possibilities in cosmology, and the applications will also find their way into things like medical imaging and particle physics as well.
Fantastic. Okay, well, we'd better wrap it up there, but it's a very exciting project for the coming years. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.